become unmanageable. Page 5. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I knew, I saw, I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I'm at business, and so I did. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Renewing my resolve, I tried again. Some time passed, and confidence began to be replaced by cocksuredness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day, I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time, I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then. And I did.
Hey, I'm Mike Midget. I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, Mike.
I've got a sobriety date of February 14th, 2017. No, I didn't know it was Valentine's Day. It wasn't anything cute. I didn't even know what year it was, I don't think, at that point. I've got a home group. It's the Sandbridge Group. We meet Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Y'all should come check it out. It's grown. It's big. We are now a big book study. We have been really excited because, as a group, we thought that the excitement of the big book was leaving the presence Alcoholics Anonymous. And we try to show that excitement and read and, you know, really get in depth with what the words actually say and not what our opinions of them are. Just going to give you a brief little summary just so I can relate to y'all. Y'all know I'm an alcoholic. I grew up in Virginia Beach. My family's been here forever, here in North Carolina. I grew up in a little house. It used to be part of our family's farmland. It turned into a neighborhood, which turned into Ocean Air Station. And I came from a great family. A lot of drugs and alcohol in various parts of the family, but I never saw any when I was young. My parents quit when they had my older brother. And when I was about, I think I was 8 years old, my mom got diagnosed with cancer. And that's when stuff really turned for me and my older brother. My brother had found a solution, you know, to search for, and he gave it to me. It was in the form of other things besides alcohol. But not too long after that, when I was about 11, I found alcohol, and it was a lot easier to get. It was a lot easier to steal, and it did the same thing. When I drank it, take a deep breath, my shoulders dropped, and I didn't have to worry about who I was or what was going on around me. And I could be, you know. At one point of the book, it says I had arrived. And that's how I felt when I drank. And that's how I felt for a long time. Right above what she just read, there's a line that says liquor ceased to be a luxury, it became a necessity. And that was, you know, that's what happened to me after years and years of battling with this. I had a big problem where I knew I was a drug addict, and for some reason that was real easy for me to relate with, but I couldn't relate to being an alcoholic, because in my life I did great things at work. I built this house and this, you know, I had a boat and the car and the family and the picket fence, and you know, inside, I had trapped my family in there. There were victims, you know, that I was killing. But on the outside, like I like to say nowadays, it was like a Facebook perfect picture of, you know, what was going on. And my wife spent most of her time switching me from bathtubs of ice to bathtubs of hot water, depending on what circumstance I was in at the time, and hiding it from a lot of people and, you know, standing up for me. But at one point, liquor ceased to be a luxury, it became a necessity. I couldn't differentiate the true from false, and it was gone from when I was little. I used to tell my mom I used to make this little symbol, and I said, something's missing. Excuse me, I'm gonna take my jacket off. Getting hot now. If I take anything else off, stop me. Gets weird. So I made that symbol, and what I found through my life was that darkness and that void got bigger and bigger. And when I hit that point of that line I just read, it consumed me. I was incapable of loving. I was incapable of being honest. I have three beautiful children, and I didn't even know how to act when they were around. You know, my best, on the page before, on page 4, Bill's watching his buddies jump out the window and stuff, and he says that disgusted him. And that's how I always was, because I had friends that were dying of alcoholism, and they were dying of overdose, and they were dying of all these things, and they were killing themselves, and it made me sick. I was like, why would you do that? But, you know, the day after I quit drinking, I told myself I'm done. I came home. My family was gone. I had nothing. The house was ransacked, and I spent about 4 months in this dark hole where most people would stop, and I didn't stop. I got worse. And I couldn't understand. I couldn't understand what this obsession was doing to me. So on February 14th, I put it down. I said, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. I can't live like this anymore. And about, I think it was 32 hours later, my best idea I could come up with was staying dry on my own, was putting pictures of my kids around and pulling a gun out and putting it in my mouth and squeezing the trigger. Nothing happened. I shucked it, put it in again, squeezed the trigger, nothing happened. I had two soft fires. And I'm an outdoors guy, and I've got guns, and it's not a common thing to happen for me. I got mad, threw the gun out, and I fell on the ground, and I felt a warmth, which was weird. Because the first time in my life, I questioned, what is my purpose here? Why am I here? There's got to be something, and I'm not going to say it was a God moment or anything, because I had no, I was out of my mind. I mean, I'm 33 hours sober at this point, maybe. And I have no idea what's going on with. I just know that thing that disgusted me, that was my only way out. And I hadn't planned it. There was like nothing romantic about it or anything. I was done. I came to a point where I could not live like this anymore. So that paragraph Miss Amy read, well, let me go a little further into that. So that's when the 12-step Alcoholics Anonymous ran into my life. A member of this program basically kicked in my door, so he had a call from some work colleagues and the few family members that still talk to me. And he gave me a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And being versed in the program, he didn't push it on me. He said, Mike, why don't you read this? See if you relate to anything. I was like, well, shit, I'll do anything right now. I just, you know. To me, it wasn't about not drinking anymore. It was about finding a way to be alive. I wanted to live. I wanted to feel. On the cover of that book, it had two things written. It said, Mike, the answers to our problems can be found. I love you. And the other thing it had was a man's name and phone number. And I recognized the man's name, and I said, is he really sober? Because I didn't believe at this point sobriety was a real thing. I'd been to AA, court ordered. I'd been to rehabs. I'd been locked up places. And I thought people came in here and they controlled it. You know, on the weekend they went out and had a couple and they lived life like normal people, and that's what happened. I didn't think people were in it for the long run. But I recognized this guy's name because he did the same stuff I did. For the first time in my life, when I saw that name and number, I felt like I could trust him because I'd been to therapists and I'd been to all this stuff. And I'm never telling those people anything, you know. They don't know. I see the picture of their family and their Porsche out front or whatever, and I'm not going to tell them. So I called him. The guy dropped whatever he was doing and took me to meetings and read this book with him. And that first line, I woke up, this had to be stopped. You know, long before this point, I woke up like that all the time. You know, I told my mom so many times, she's going through treatment, dealing with real stuff, and I'm sitting here being a POS drunk. And I'd tell her I'm done, you know, she'd say, when are you going to stop? I'd say, I'm done. 100% honest every time I said that. I could not figure out what led me to that first drink. And I could not figure out why, when I took that first drink, I could not stop drinking. I mean, everything written in there. Before then, I'd written a lot of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed. You know how many times my wife happily observed that statement? Maybe it'll happen. Maybe this time something's gonna happen. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. After a while, there is no fuck. I mean, you gotta think, like, now that I'm sober, I think back, like, how freaking insane are we that we keep repeating this process? And the people on the outside are like, the hell are you doing? I'll go ahead and pass.
Anthony Rondo, recovered alcoholic.
Hey, Anthony.
And my sobriety date is March 29th, 2015. My home group is also Sarum Bridge on Tuesday nights, 8 o'clock. Have a sponsor that I work with on a daily basis. And getting in the program has been the biggest thing that's made a difference in my life. Though my sobriety date is in 2015, I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous until February of 2019. So I spent 4 years on my own, afraid each and every day that the more time I got dry and sober, that if I had gone back out to drink at any moment, that I wouldn't be able to handle the fact that I had just given up all this sobriety and I stayed sober out of fear that I might kill myself if I went back out drinking again. It was a very real fear. I didn't identify as an alcoholic at that time. And, you know, maybe through some of the stuff I'll talk about tonight, I'll explain a bit more as to why. But I didn't identify as an alcoholic. But the funny thing was, I was listening to AA meetings on tape, on podcasts, coming and going to work. And I heard somebody share that someone who had been in the program walked away from the program with a long time of active recovery. They just said, you know, hey, I've been sober and working with somebody for whatever the time was, like 20 years, and I don't need the program anymore. I don't need, you know, the fellowship. I don't need to be calling my sponsor. I don't need to be doing service work. And they walked away from the program, and it lasted like 2 months or something. They ended up killing themselves. And when I heard that, I thought, oh my. And that's what kept me sober, and it was freaking miserable. But, you know, in listening to those meetings on tape, there's this one speaker I ended up just really liking. His name is Kent C. from Sandusky, Ohio. And he said something one time that made me laugh and like cry all at once. He said, alcohol didn't run in my family at Gallup. And I thought, dang, you know, it was funny, but it was sad at the same time. Like, I should have seen it coming. I should have heard it coming. I was just in the middle of a violent, abusive, alcoholic family from the day I was born. When I was, my mom tells a story, and I can't remember, but so much of it. I started to remember some things about the time I was maybe 5 or 6, but she tells a story about when I was 3 years old, you know, my dad beating my mom across the head with a pot that she had made dinner in that wasn't good enough for him. And so my dad beat my mom across the head until she fell in the front room of this trailer we lived in this trailer park. And at like 3 years old, I was the one comforting her. And that was pretty much my life for as long as I can remember. Even though they split, he would come into the house holidays, birthdays, any night, any time, you know, break into the house, tear down the Christmas tree, beat the crap out of my mom, push me around a little bit here and there. And it was just, alcohol was there in my family and in my life in a very bad way from my very first memory. And it wasn't just with my dad, it was with my grandfather on his side, it was with all four of his brothers. And we grew up in a small town, so when I got into the school system, you know, they'd recognize my last name and they said, oh, you're one of those boys. And I thought, oh boy, here we go, you know. And so I knew early on I had to show and prove that I wasn't that type of person. And whether that not that meant an alcoholic or not, you know, I didn't know early on, but that's what I was out to do, was to prove to everybody that I was not an alcoholic. But very early on, and my mom remarried for a couple of years, and she actually married somebody in the police department. It was actually the president of the state fraternal police. And so when I got into drinking and alcohol, and at age 14, and driving the car around this small little town at age 14, and everybody kind of knew who I was because I was, even though I was a freshman, I was involved in varsity sports and whatnot. And then he was also in the community, and I didn't get in trouble. I didn't get pulled over because they didn't want to give me a ticket, you know, because he would have come down on them. So I had a scapegoat. I was let to run wild. And so what I started to do was just drink to feel normal and fit in. And it didn't take long for that to alcohol really to be something that just numbed me out to where I didn't think about all those things I had seen and heard at night. I didn't think about all the resentments that I was developing. I could just push those to the side. And it was, you know, yeah, I had some fun drinking, sure. But really, where it became a problem for me was when I would stop drinking, I would start feeling things. And, you know, every weekend at age 15, I was out drinking liquor with the seniors in high school and, you know, dabbling in a little bit of other outside issues here and there. And like I said, I was fitting in, but also it was numbing everything out. And I used that to numb me for another 20 years, really. And it worked great until it didn't, because I started to become all the things that I was trying to prove that I wasn't. I started to become violent with my wife and my kids. You know, I started to become violent towards my own mom and my family. Not always physically, but often verbally abusive, and I had a lot of anger and resentment, and it was just eating me alive. And so, you know, I had a lot of ups and downs, and I escaped a lot of nights I probably should have spent in jail because of people who knew who I was and didn't want to be the one to lock me up. So I got lucky, really. But, you know, it came to a point where when I got married and I started having kids, and you know, I started realizing all the things that I had spent my whole entire life trying to show you that I was not, by going and, you know, my dad didn't graduate high school. No one in his family graduated high school, so they didn't go to college. So I went to high school, went to a military college, went and got a good job, and I was just putting up all these different things to make my mom and everyone else in my family realize that I did not become one of these people. But inside my home, I was doing all the things that were just, you know, that I had witnessed and that I had promised myself that I would never do. And that my mom would tell me she was so proud of me for not. And so I started making quiet promises to myself that I was going to stop drinking. I wouldn't tell anybody. I didn't admit I was an alcoholic. I was just going to stop drinking. And the first time I tried to do that was in 2004. And for the next 11 years, I was on and off every 6 months with some sort of self-help book that told me, hey, if you can do this, you're not an alcoholic. So, okay, great. I did that. I'm not an alcoholic. I'm good. Go back to drinking, start drinking again. And everything just got worse than it was the time before. You know? So anyway, I bounced back and forth between sobriety and promises to myself, never once admitting to anyone I was an alcoholic. Certainly not seeking help. My ego was too big for that, and it would mean that I'd have to tell people that everything I promised them and told them I was doing was a lie. So that's how I ended up in March of 2015, sober by myself for 4 years. And I honestly believe that for 4 years I was worse off than I was when I was drinking, because I had no solution. I had nothing to numb away all of the anger. And I mean, there were moments, I swear to God, I stood there and contemplated during an argument whether or not I should just choke out the person in front of me. And, you know, sometimes it would be my wife. And then one time in February of 2019, I had a complete, total mental freaking breakdown in the middle of this world that I had put together and pieced together and was holding on with, you know, complete desperation to. And I just said, I need a solution. I said, I need help spiritually. I remember telling her, I need help spiritually. And I just thought, there's somebody in the program, or that I thought was in the program, at least I had a connection. And I reached out to them, and they put me in touch with someone who in the Sandbridge group. And I, within 2 days, went to the AA meeting that they recommended I go to, and I haven't stopped going back. I've been working with a sponsor. The obsession for me was not lifted until I started doing that. I thought about alcohol from the moment I can remember. I had, you know, it was a part of my life, and I couldn't figure out whether or not I should be drinking. If I did, how much? You know, if I did drink, what did it mean? Was I an alcoholic? If I drank and behaved a certain way, am I alcoholic? And it was just constant mental chaos. And that stopped when I got a sponsor and went through. So anyway, I mean, you know, this book and the solution that's contained within it is really what saved my life and got me into a position where I actually feel like a good father and a good husband and a good son. And my resentments that I used to carry around with me from my dad passed 12 years ago. And I used to say that I thought about him from the moment I woke up to the moment I went to sleep. And really, it was true. First thing I thought of in the morning was about him. Last thing I thought about him was about him. But it was the fucking resentment, excuse my language, that I thought about. It wasn't a good time, you know. And I don't do that anymore. I don't harp on it. When I wake up in the morning, I say a prayer to God for all the good stuff. But, you know, when we talk this section that was read, you know, one more attempt and one more failure was my story for a good 11, 12 years. And where had been my high resolve, I didn't really have any, because I wasn't telling anybody what I was doing. In 2014, I skipped out on a Father's Day get-together. And I was at home by myself in my house, and I was admitting, you know, this is crazy. This is it. I'm done. And I made a promise again to myself. I didn't tell my wife. I didn't tell my kids. I didn't tell anyone in my family. And I was going to do it all on self-knowledge and self-will. And it lasted for a couple of months. And I got into a situation where I was with some friends, and they pushed a drink my way, and I didn't have any defense against that first drink. It was my best friend's wedding. You know, my next drink after that was in a hot tub with three other guys. It's not really the way I wanted to go out. You know, if I could have done something differently, I probably should have. But I didn't even think about it. You know, it was the night before his wedding. He handed me a drink. I hadn't told him I was trying to stop drinking. He just knew I was. Hadn't been drinking for. He handed me a drink, and I thought, hey, fine, drank it. Drank the whole night, drove home, from Sandbridge to my house drunk. Next night was a wedding. Did the same thing. Didn't even think about it. My wife wasn't there the previous night. She was there that night. So when he handed me the drink, she gave me this side eye. Like, I know you haven't been drinking, but you didn't really make a commitment to me. But like, what the hell is going on here? You know? And so hey, it's a wedding. Let's have fun. I drank all night and I drank for the next, like about 9 months, I guess it was. And towards the end of that 6 months, I was drinking every day as much as I could get in before midnight, because midnight was the magic time. Because then I could say when I went to work that morning, I haven't been drinking today, you know? So just kind of working that equation as much as I could to fit my needs. And the remorse and the horror and the hopelessness that is talked about just outside of the paragraphs that were read of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. There's a terrible sense that on the way home, I was going to have to figure out what store I was going to stop at so that, you know, the lady serving me my alcohol that night didn't realize that I'd been there every night for the past week, you know. And then that hopelessness and horror of, here I am again, 6:05, got home as soon as I can, I'm drinking right away. And that beat me up and beat me up and beat me up until I stopped drinking out of complete total fear, and I went through hell for the next 4 days. That too much, you know. Maybe some of that more will come out as I share on the rest of these paragraphs we're about to read. But anyway, I certainly relate to not having that first line of defense and the hopelessness and the horror of not being able to develop that defense. That's what I got. Thanks for letting me share.
Thanks. The reading continues on page 7. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was understanding myself now. I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge.
Sorry, you know, my sponsor told me years ago it would get so much easier when you speak. And it's funny because I'm not a speaker, and then I come up and do these things, and every time I get asked, and it's an honor and a privilege to do it, but my throat gets all dry, I get all sweaty, and telling the truth in front of my people, it should be the easiest thing to do, but I drink gallons of water while I'm up here too. So like Bill's story to me is summed up as one more attempt, one more failure. In the last reading, you know, he gets cocky and he's ready and, you know, I'm laughing at the gin mills, and then he's drunk. He can't figure it out. And this is his first stint in the hospital. So he goes in the hospital and, you know, they start explaining some things to him, and being a true alcoholic mind, he's like, oh, this makes sense now. You know, now I know why I do. The line before what Miss Amy read was, I'd been seriously ill bodily and mentally. You know, this thing's threefold. I've got this mind that obsesses, and I don't even know it's obsessing. So if I have a good day, I'm gonna drink because it's a good day. If I have a bad day, I'm gonna drink because it's a bad day. If it's hot outside, I'm gonna drink to cool off. If it's cold outside, I'm gonna drink to warm up. There's no day that I don't drink. And I remember being in a rehab, and I was coming off pretty heavy, and a lady looked at me. We were in some kind of session. She was talking about triggers. It's the most BS word to me, but she's going around the room, what are your triggers? I remember my head was down. I looked up at her and I said, waking up, that's what it is. I mean, I'm an alcoholic. Nothing triggers me to drink. If you yell at me, I'm not going to go drink. If I'm mad at my wife and I'm not an alcoholic, I can go get a new wife, right? That's not what's making me drink. I've got this obsession, and once I succumb to that, and I don't even know I'm doing it usually after I take the first one, especially if I'm trying to stop, I'm like, how'd I get here? But then this allergy comes on, you know, the phenomenon of craving. I can't stop. There's no off switch. Most importantly, I can't stay stopped. You know, I've stopped many times for a month or a year. And like Anthony was describing, I am worse when I do. When you take away my solution, which is what I know it is, everything, the irritable, restless, discontent. I mean, I'm 100 times on all that. The people that are begging me not to drink are like begging me to drink now because I can't live around me. Like, what the hell are you doing? And you know, my opinion, this is just an opinion, doesn't say this in the book, is I was born this way, and I think a lot of us are, because when I was a little kid, never good enough ever until I started. And then when I started and found something, and I still do it today, if I'm not doing what I'm supposed to be doing, I want more. And if I'm not Those times I quit drinking, I'm going to amplify everything else in my life. I'm going to argue harder. I'm going to fight harder. And all that is going to give me a solution. Everything me a solution. And it's usually, from what I notice, none of it is good that gives me my solution. But he fared forth in high hope, self-knowledge. Self-knowledge is kind of like a tricky part of this program, because you gotta learn something about yourself, right? But you also gotta know that's not getting you. I don't know how many of you have been in the rooms, but there's a lot of doctors in these rooms. There's a lot of therapists in these rooms. There's a lot of substance abuse people in these rooms, counselors. Those people have all the self-knowledge in the world, right? That's all they do is read about this. They're sitting in these rooms right next to us. I'm a dumb construction worker. You know, it wasn't until a man took time and read this book to me the way I needed it. I needed it dumbed down, just for black and white, just what it is, right? And I needed to look up some words, and I needed to relate to Bill's story in the time period they're in. The paragraph before, his wife goes to work and he's stealing from her, right? And you know, that time it was a little bit rare for women to be at work and the man to be at home. He's at home making bathtubs full of gin, and she's out working, coming home exhausted, and he's stealing a little bit of money. You know, at one point it says he uses the money to pay off his bills at the bars and the delicatessens, because, you know, he might get a bite to eat here or there, but he's going to make sure the people feeding him a solution. Good.
Well, you know, I think that self-knowledge and my desire to kind of feed my ego and keep all my failings a secret, you know, it really led to me white knuckling it for so many years. You know, I was determined to do everything on my own. I was not going to admit to anyone that I was an alcoholic. That would have been the opportunity for me to ask for help, more than likely, you know, you would think. But I didn't do that. I went to Barnes & Noble and bought every book I could find with the name alcoholic in the title, but not Alcoholics Anonymous. And I really liked the ones that said, for adult children of alcoholics, because that's what I was. I was an adult child of an alcoholic, and it was everyone else's fault but my own. But in this book, I could find enough information to make me feel like it was everyone else's fault but my own. And like, there might be a way to fix this if I could just extract these couple of paragraphs here and apply it to me, then I've got everything I need to be a good person, right? And I mean, I had my hand on Alcoholics Anonymous a few times, but I was too embarrassed to go up and buy it from somebody at the register that I had no idea who this person was. Why did I care? I would never see that person a day again in my life. But I didn't. And really, if I had, it wouldn't have done me any good, because I would have opened this book up and applied my own way of thinking to it. Everything in here, I would have found a way to manipulate into a way that fit me and my needs and my desires, that, you know, likely I would have tried to say, yeah, this is good, let me extract this, but I'm not an alcoholic, I'm not all these things, I don't need a higher power, I don't need to do these steps, you know. So I'm actually thinking about it right now, thoughts occurring to me, I'm glad I didn't pick up the book by myself. I'm glad I didn't attempt to read it. When I first started in Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody was mentioning to me, who's not in the program and at the time didn't know that I was, you know, they were talking about their own issues with drinking. And they mentioned that, man, I picked up that book, Alcoholics Anonymous, I read some of those stories in the back, and that shit is crazy, and I don't relate to anything of it, and I'm not going to AA. And that's exactly what I would have done. I would have reasoned my way right out of this. I would have used my self-knowledge, because I'm so smart, to prove that I was an alcoholic and this program was not for me. But, you know, the best decision I could have made in my life as it relates to alcohol and all the issues caused by it was to recognize I don't know anything about alcohol. My will is strong in many ways. I went out and proved to people that I could do a lot of different things. And I actually had a couple of friends of mine in the intervals that I stopped drinking for 60 days or whatever it was to prove to somebody that I was an alcoholic, because it was about to be bad, you know. Let me distract my mom here for a couple months, I won't drink. Let me distract my wife for a few months, I won't drink. I would have friends at the time tell me, man, I wish I had your willpower. You're really good. I can't believe you're not drinking for what. But I would define it. 30 days, day 31, I'm back at it, hard as I can. So, I mean, a lot of people told me my willpower was good. Like I said, I went to a college, I was pretty intense. And, you know, getting through that, you know, a lot of people said, hey, man, it takes a lot of willpower to get through something like that. Good on you, you know. And so I was capable of doing a lot of things, but amazingly weak when it came to combating liquor. And I tried to find ways to solve it on my own. I just couldn't. And like I said, I'm extremely grateful for the fact that for me personally, I feel like it's good I didn't pick up this book by myself, because I would probably throw it in the trash like all the other self-helps that I tried to do my own self-knowledge with. So anyway, self-knowledge for me was not the solution. Fortunate to have found it in the big book. Thanks.
We're going to move over to page 24 for the next reading. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our conscious force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot plate. I'm going to continue on page 30. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently may be, has to be smashed. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drink. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better.
All right, so in between those readings, Bill gets a call from Ebby Thatcher, right? He's from the Oxford group. And Bill, just like when I read that name on the front of my book, says, oh, this guy's a drinker. So he agrees to talk to him. It doesn't work out at first, but you know, it's important to know Bill. He goes to the hospital once, self-knowledge sobers him up for a bit, and he fails. He goes to the hospital again, and he sobers up out of fear because he's dying. Now the third time he's in the hospital, he's laying in the bed detoxing, and you know, back then they locked you up for being criminally insane, doped you up, did stuff. It's like the horror movies you watch about mental pain. That's you were done. Ebby was on his way to getting locked up when two other men from the Oxford group saved him from the judge, walked in and said, can we try some? They agreed. So he's in his hospital bed, and Ebby takes Bill through the original, what was six steps of the Oxford, and Bill recovers, right? I love what Amy just read. We're unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. That answers to me why every time I go out, it doesn't matter. And that, why I'm questioning why I'm doing this is exactly that. I don't remember when it comes down to that point. If I'm on probation and I'm not supposed to be drinking, I'm gonna drink because at that point, I'm not remembering the pain and suffering. If I just got out of the hospital and I was dying from this, and I pick up that drink, what just happened to me doesn't matter anymore. That's the obsession, right? And that's why they made this program, Life or Death. It says what's going to happen. It tells you, I don't know, probably 50 times, you do this or die, do this or else. I mean, you got to pay attention to those strong words in the book. And this is what happened to me. My sponsor loved me enough when I did my first step and I admitted that I was powerless and my life was unmanageable. And my life being unmanageable wasn't, you know, my house getting taken away and my family gone. It was that I lost myself. I had nothing. I call it godless now. When I did the first manly thing, which was to ask another man on a date, as weird as that sounds, something happened right then. I had made a first step. I admitted I asked for help. Now, he loved me enough to say, Mike, you're dying. Are you going to do this or what? It's like, I don't have time to waste with you. If you don't want to do it, don't do it. But you're going to die if you... You know, I'd walked in these rooms court-ordered and stuff, and people patted me on the back and told me to sit here. It'll come to you. It's ridiculous. Me sitting in that chair listening to y'all talk is not going to help me. That's like me sitting in a bar and looking at a bottle of liquor expecting to get drunk on it. I've got to take the action of putting that bottle to... You know, our line comes from an old... It's an old line. I can go all the way back to Bill himself in our line, and that's pretty cool. I take great pride in it. But we come from, people call it baseball bat sobriety. Of course, I love the guys I sponsor, and I want them to get better, but I got to remember one thing. My only expectation of them, just like my sponsor's only expectation of me, is that I'm going to drink, because I'm an alcoholic, and that's what I'm supposed to be doing. Every second I'm not doing that's like a miracle. When I gave in, he read me through this book, got me to understand a few things, and he rapidly took me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a very simple process. I sit in these rooms and hear how difficult it is, and people sit on their fourth step for 6 months or don't do this till a year. To me, it's bullshit because it's not the way I did it. If that's the way you did it, that's perfectly fine. It's cool that you're sober. I love that too. When I talk, I've got to talk to the man that was like me in the back of the room with Thunderfoot that isn't going to get this program, and he just needs to know he's going to die if he doesn't. And I can be the one person that comes in and doesn't pat him on the back and says, hey, you need some help, here's my number, you're going to die, just like happened to me. And I can rapidly take him through the steps because of that line we just read. If he sits in this meeting and goes to 90 meetings in 90 days and has no solution, what's he going to do? He's not going to remember the pain or suffering of a week or a month ago. I wouldn't. I've proven that countless times. My best thinking got a gun in my mouth wanting to die. I don't even know if I wanted to die. I didn't want to live. So through taking these steps, I can tell you what happened. I woke up the next morning with a sense of peace and serenity that I thought was bullshit that y'all told me. I woke up the next morning and had no desire to put anything in my body for the first time since I was 8 years old. That's pretty cool. You know, I get to be a husband now. That family that left me, or I gave away more like it, they took me back. I get to be a father. I get to be there. Actually be there when we do stuff and feel. I remember walking on the balcony of this apartment I was staying in that somebody in the fellowship got for me because I had given everything away in my life after doing the steps, and I felt the wind, and I said, I don't even believe I've felt the wind before. Maybe I just didn't care to feel it, but I felt it that morning. I've got a pretty cool life. I do some pretty cool stuff. I'm a valuable employee. Sometimes I go do like fighting now, like organized fighting, where I don't even really want to hurt the guy. It's a pretty humbling experience. I started doing it, got me in shape, and it's fun, man. And, you know, get to hug the person afterwards, not want to kill him. All the things I thought I'd never do, I do now, and I enjoy doing them. I enjoy the hell out of being here looking at all y'all Monday night at whatever time it is. That's pretty cool. And I know I get to go home. I know my mom, if she dies of this, which she still has, is going to die, and I'm going to be there by her side. I know my kids are going to be at home waiting for me to get home. You know, my teenagers, they're not really going to care that much, but they're going to hear the door open. My five-year-old, he's going to be waiting there because he's not going to go to bed for mom. He's going to want dad to read him a book. That's pretty cool.
I'm kind of sucking all that in. Powerful, good stuff there at the beginning, Mike. You know, I think the thing that I have to remember for myself is, you know, the almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. And, you know, my consequences don't have to be the same as anybody in this room, and yours don't have to be the same as mine. The ones that I have felt and suffered matter to me tremendously. I have lots of reasons to try and avoid those consequences again in my life. And there was a period of time where I had a hard time, you know, recalling what life was like when I was drinking. I would romanticize the heck out of you know, any event that I used to get together with my friends and family and drink, and I would only think about the good times. I'd only think about those first X number of drinks where we're laughing and joking and having a good time. I wouldn't be thinking about my action at the end of the night or the things that I would choose to skip out on the next morning. Those didn't come to mind. And I before I started in Alcoholics Anonymous, like I said before, I didn't have a solution. I hadn't worked the steps. I didn't believe in a higher power. I would often flash back to, you know, the good day of drinking. And I'd try and package those moments and find a way to justify drinking again. I'm going to miss out on this event because I'm not drinking. I'm not going to go to this event, you know, and my wife and I aren't going to go to this event because I'm not drinking. Gosh, it'd be better for both of us if I started drinking again, actually. You know, because then we could go to this event down the street. I mean, I was just forgetting everything that came along with it. It's a package deal for me. I start drinking, I start behaving a certain way. Eventually. I might make it a week. Cool. Day eight, done. From day eight to whenever. You know, so the thing is, that's kind of odd for me right now, is I don't think about alcohol. I don't think about the good times. I don't think about the bad. I had family in town from Texas. There's bottles of some sort of vodka. I don't have any idea what it is sitting on my counter. They're actually staying somewhere else. I'm at home by myself tonight. I was at home by myself the other night. I'll be at home by myself tomorrow. That bottle of liquor is still sitting on that counter. I could give two crap. I could care less. There'd be days where I was dry without a solution, sitting there. I'd stare at that bottle. I'd have to pour it down the drain. I'd have to shatter it into 1,000 pieces to keep from trying to shake the last drop that didn't make it down the drain. I don't need to do that anymore. I feel like I am spiritually fit to the point where I can go and do the things that alcoholics shouldn't do. It says it in the book. I check my motivation. Why am I going? What am I doing this for? Am I spiritually fit? If I am, let's go. Let's live life. Let's enjoy each other's company. Without alcohol, it's actually possible. I never thought it was going to be possible. I still have plenty of friends who do a lot of things that I used to do. Let them have their good time. And I can go out with them on those nights and I can have just as much fun. So it's just kind of interesting, my relationship with alcohol prior to coming into AA and all the self-knowledge I tried to apply to make things right, and the fact that I don't even feel like I have a relationship with alcohol right now, man. I don't know how to express that other than to say that I just don't think. So I'm forgetting, but in a different way. You know, I'm forgetting because I have a solution, because I believe in a higher power, because this program gives me the tools that I need to get through my life without even for a moment in any given day thinking alcohol could be better, because it's not, never has been, never will be. Just like it was read in some of these last few paragraphs. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently maybe, has to be smashed. We've lost the ability to control our drinking. I'm never going to be able to control my drinking. And I'm okay with that. And it's only because I actively worked the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, so that's what I got. Thanks for letting me share.
All right. I'm going to finish this out on page 43. Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. We are going to pass the basket or have the basket somewhere in accordance with the seventh tradition. While contribution, each AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup central office, local services, district, area, and the general service office itself supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose. Announcements. Are there any AA-related announcements? I have an announcement. Simple Actions is going to go back to Zoom, effective next Monday. So it's been wonderful to see everyone. It's 2 weeks, but that is our group conscience at this time. So hopefully we will see you all next week. Step two. In our Zoom room, which is posted at simpleactions.net. Any other announcements?
It'll be up on TIC.
Okay. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Newcomers, is there anyone in their first 30 days of sobriety? We'd like to welcome you. All right. Where? Pardon me. What is your name so we can welcome you? Elsa? Welcome, Elsa. It's good to have you. Literature is available on the table over there. Please see me or any home group member after the meeting. Sponsorship. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, I will be available at this table after we close the meeting. Please feel free to come talk to me. I'd like to help you get hooked up. In closing, can we please thank Mike and Anthony again for their time? And who has a book that would like to volunteer to read page 160? Oh, will you do it?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. This book is meant to
be. Oh, there we go. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come, if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you all and keep you until then. Amen.
And this group has opted to stay in place and close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not to temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Thanks, everybody, for coming.
Oh, yes, no problem.